still traces of earth, but it had been fused into lava. All the rest had been swept away, leaving uncovered the stubborn shell which neither time nor any natural force could ever touch. With Hilvar by his side, Avan stood in the open door and looked back at the silent senators. He wondered what they were thinking, what, indeed, the whole of Lys was thinking. From their expressions, it almost seemed as if they were beyond thought.
"I'm going to Shalmarain, and I will be back in Airlie within an hour or so, but that is only a beginning. And while I'm away, there is a thought I would leave with you. This is no ordinary flyer, of the kind in which men traveled over the earth. It is a spaceship, one of the fastest ever built. If you want to know where I found it, you will find the answer in Diaspar. But you will have to go there, for Diaspar will never come to you."
He turned to Hilvar and gestured to the door. Hilvar hesitated for a moment only, looking back once at the familiar scenes around him. Then he stepped forward into the airlock. The senators watched until the ship, now moving quite slowly, for it had only a little way to go, had disappeared into the south. Then the gray-haired young man who led the group shrugged his shoulders philosophically and turned to one of his colleagues.
"You've always opposed us for wanting change, and so far you have won. But I don't think the future lies with either of our groups now. Lys and Diaspar have both come to the end of an era, and we must make the best of it."
"I am afraid you are right. This is a crisis, and Avan knew what he was saying when he told us to go to Diaspar. They know about us now, so there is no further purpose in concealment. I think we had better get in touch with our cousins. We may find them more anxious to cooperate now."
"But the subway is closed on both ends."
"We can open ours. It will not be long before Diaspar does the same."
The minds of the senators, those in Airlie and those scattered over the whole width of Lys, considered the proposal and disliked it heartily, but they saw no alternative. Sooner than he had any right to expect, the seed that Avan had planted was beginning to flower. The mountains were still swimming in shadow when they reached Shalmarain. From their height, the great bowl of the fortress looked very small. It seemed impossible that the fate of Earth had once depended on that tiny ebon circle. When Avan brought the ship to rest among the ruins by the lakeside, the desolation crowded in upon him, chilling his soul. He opened the airlock, and the stillness of the place crept into the ship. Hilvar, who had scarcely spoken during the entire flight, asked quietly,
"Why have you come here again?"
Avan did not answer until they had almost reached the edge of the lake. Then he said,
"I wanted to show you what this ship was like, and I also hoped that the polyp might be in existence once more. I feel I owe it a debt, and I want to tell it what I've discovered."
"In that case, you will have to wait. You have come back much too soon."
Avan had expected that. It had been a remote chance, and he was not disappointed that it had failed. The waters of the lake were perfectly still, no longer beating with that steady rhythm that had so puzzled them on their first visit. He knelt down at the water's edge and peered into the cold, dark depths. Tiny translucent bells, trailing almost invisible tentacles, were drifting to and fro beneath the surface. Avan plunged in his hand and scooped one up. He dropped it at once with a slight exclamation of annoyance. It had stung him. Someday, perhaps years, perhaps centuries in the future, these mindless jellies would reassemble, and the great polyp would be reborn as its memories linked together and its consciousness flashed into existence once again. Avan wondered how it would receive the discoveries he had made. It might not be pleased to learn the truth about the Master. Indeed, it might refuse to admit that all its ages of patient waiting had been in vain. Yet had they? Deluded though these creatures might have been, their long vigil had at last brought its reward. As if by a miracle, they had saved from the past knowledge that else might have been lost forever. Now they could rest at last, and their creed could go the way of a million other faiths that had once thought themselves eternal. Hilvar and Avan walked in reflective silence back to the waiting ship. presently the fortress was once again a dark shadow among the hills. It dwindled swiftly until it became a black and lidless eye staring up forever into space, and soon they lost it in the great panorama of Lys. Alvin did nothing to check the machine. Still they rose until the whole of Lys lay spread beneath them, a green island in an ochre sea. Never before had Alvin been so high. When finally they came to rest, the whole crescent of the earth was visible below. Lys was very small now, only an emerald stain against the rusty desert. But far around the curve of the globe, something was glittering like a man-colored jewel. And so, for the first time, Hilvar saw the city of Diaspar. They sat for a long while watching the earth turn beneath them. Of all man's ancient powers, this surely was the one he could least afford to lose. Alvin wished he could show the world as he saw it now to the rulers of Lys and Diaspar.
Hilvar, do you think that what I'm doing is right?
The question surprised Hilvar, who did not suspect the sudden doubts that sometimes overwhelmed his friend, and still knew nothing of Alvin's meeting with the central computer and the impact which that had had upon his mind. It was not an easy question to answer dispassionately. Like Kedron, though with less cause, Hilvar felt that his own character was becoming submerged. He was being sucked helplessly into the vortex which Alvin left behind him on his way through life.
I believe you are right. Our two peoples have been separated for long enough.
That, he thought, was true, though he knew that his own feelings must bias his reply. But Alvin was still worried.
There's one problem that bothers me, and that's the difference in our lifespans.
He said no more, but each knew what the other was thinking.
I've been worried about that as well. But I think the problem will solve itself in time when our people get to know each other again. We can't both be right. Our lives may be too short, and yours are certainly far too long. Eventually, there will be a compromise.
Alvin wondered. That way, it was true, lay the only hope. But the ages of transition would be hard indeed. He remembered again those bitter words of Serana's.
Both he and I will have been dead for centuries, while you are still a youth.
Very well, he would accept the conditions. Even in Diaspar, all friendships lay under the same shadow. Whether it was 100 or 1,000,000 years away made little difference at the end. Alvin knew, with a certainty that passed all logic, that the welfare of the race demanded the mingling of these two cultures. In such a cause, individual happiness was unimportant. For a moment, Alvin saw humanity as something more than the living background of his own life, and he accepted, without flinching, the unhappiness his choice must one day bring. Beneath them, the world continued on its endless turning. Sensing his friend's mood, Hilvar said nothing, until presently Alvin broke the silence.
When I first left Diaspar, I did not know what I hoped to find. Lys would have satisfied me once, more than satisfied me. Yet now, everything on Earth seems so small and unimportant. Each discovery I've made has raised bigger questions and opened up wider horizons. I wonder where it will end.
Hilvar had never seen Alvin in so thoughtful a mood, and did not wish to interrupt his soliloquy. He had learned a great deal about his friend in the last few minutes.
The robot told me that this ship can reach the seven suns in less than a day. Do you think I should go?
Do you think I could stop you?
Alvin smiled.
That's no answer. Who knows what lies out there in space? The invaders may have left the universe, but there may be other intelligences unfriendly to man.
Why should there be? That's one of the questions our philosophers have been debating for ages. A truly intelligent race is not likely to be unfriendly.
But the invaders...
They are an enigma, I admit. If they were really vicious, they must have destroyed themselves by now. And even if they have not...
Hilvar pointed to the unending deserts below.
Once we had an empire. What have we now that they would covet?
Alvin was a little surprised that anyone else shared this point of view, so closely allied to his own.
Do all your people think this way?
Only a minority. The average person doesn't worry about it, but would probably say that if the invaders really wanted to destroy Earth, they'd have done it ages ago. I don't suppose anyone is actually afraid of them.
Things are very different in Diaspar. My people are great cowards. They are terrified of leaving their city, and I don't know what will happen when they hear I've located a spaceship. Jezerak will have told the Council by now, and I would like to know what it is doing.
I can tell you that. It is preparing to receive its first delegation from Lys. Serranus has just told me.
Alvin looked again at the screen. He could span the distance between Lys and Diaspar in a single glance. Though one of his aims had been achieved, that seemed a small matter now. Yet he was very glad. Now, surely, the long ages of sterile isolation would be ending. The knowledge that he had succeeded in what had once been his main mission cleared away the last doubts from Alvin's mind. He had fulfilled his purpose here on Earth more swiftly and more thoroughly than he had dared to hope. The way lay clear ahead for what might be his last and would certainly be his greatest adventure.
Will you come with me, Hilvar?
Alvin was all too conscious of what he was asking. Hilvar looked at him steadfastly.
There is no need to ask that, Alvin. I told Serranus and all my friends that I was leaving with you a good hour ago.
They were very high when Alvin gave the robot its instructions. The ship had come almost to rest, and the Earth was perhaps 1,000 miles below, nearly filling the sky. It looked very uninviting. Alvin wondered how many ships in the past had hovered here for a little while and then continued on their way. There was an appreciable pause, as if the robot was checking controls and circuits that had not been used for geological ages. Then came a very faint sound, the first that Alvin had ever heard from a machine. It was a tiny humming, which soared swiftly octave by octave until it was lost at the edge of hearing. There was no sense of change of motion, but suddenly he noticed that the stars were drifting across the screen. The Earth reappeared and rolled past, then appeared again in a slightly different position. The ship was hunting, swinging in space like a compass needle seeking the north. For minutes, the skies turned and twisted around them until at last the ship came to rest, a giant projectile aimed at the stars. Centered in the screen, the great ring of the 7 suns lay in its rainbow-hued beauty. A little of Earth was still visible as a dark crescent edged with the gold and crimson of the sunset. Something was happening now, Alvin knew, beyond all his experience. He waited, gripping his seat, while the seconds drifted by and the 7 suns glittered on the screen. There was no sound, only a sudden wrench that seemed to blur the vision. But Earth had vanished as if a giant hand had whipped it away. They were alone in space, alone with the stars, and a strangely shrunken sun. Earth was gone as though it had never been. Again came that wrench, and with it now the faintest murmur of sound, as if for the first time the generators were exerting some appreciable fraction of their power. Yet for a moment it seemed that nothing had happened. Then Alvin realized that the sun itself was gone, and that the stars were creeping slowly past the ship. He looked back for an instant and saw nothing. All the heavens behind had vanished utterly, obliterated by a hemisphere of night. Even as he watched, he could see the stars plunge into it, to disappear like sparks falling upon water. The ship was traveling far faster than light, and Alvin knew that the familiar space of Earth and sun held him no more. When that sudden vertiginous wrench came for the third time, his heart almost stopped beating. The strange blurring of vision was unmistakable now. For a moment his surroundings seemed distorted out of recognition. The meaning of that distortion came to him in a flash of insight he could not explain. It was real, and no delusion of his eyes. Somehow he was catching, as he passed through the thin film of the present, a glimpse of the changes that were occurring in the space around him. At the same instant, the murmur of the generators rose to a roar that shook the ship, sound doubly impressive, for it was the first cry of protest that Alvin had ever heard from a machine. Then it was all over, and the sudden silence seemed to ring in his ears. The great generators had done their work. They would not be needed again until the end of the voyage. The stars ahead flared blue-white and vanished into the ultraviolet, yet by some magic of science or nature, the 7 suns were still visible, though now their positions and colors were subtly changed. The ship was hurtling toward them along a tunnel of darkness, beyond the boundaries of space and time, at a velocity too enormous for the mind to contemplate. It was hard to believe that they had now been flung out of the solar system at a speed which, unless it were checked, would soon take them through the heart of the galaxy and into the greater emptiness beyond. Neither Alvin nor Hilvar could conceive the real immensity of their journey. The great sagas of exploration had completely changed man's outlook toward the universe, and even now, millions of centuries later, The ancient traditions had not wholly died. There had once been a ship, legend whispered, that had circumnavigated the cosmos between the rising and the setting of the sun. The billions of miles between the stars meant nothing before such speeds. To Alvin, this voyage was very little greater, and perhaps less dangerous, than his first journey to Lys. It was Hilvar who voiced both their thoughts as the seven suns slowly brightened ahead.
Alvin, that formation can't possibly be natural.
The other nodded.
I've thought that for years, but it still seems fantastic.
The system may not have been built by man, but intelligence must have created it. Nature could never have formed that perfect circle of stars, all equally brilliant, and there's nothing else in the visible universe like the central sun.
Why should such a thing have been made then?
Oh, I can think of many reasons. Perhaps it's a signal so that any strange ship entering our universe will know where to look for life. Perhaps it marks the center of galactic administration. Or perhaps, and somehow I feel that this is the real explanation, it's simply the greatest of all works of art. But it's foolish to speculate now. In a few hours, we shall know the truth.
We shall know the truth. Perhaps, thought Alvin, but how much of it shall we ever know? It seemed strange that now, while he was leaving Diaspar, and indeed Earth itself, at a speed beyond all comprehension, his mind should turn once more to the mystery of his origin. Yet perhaps it was not so surprising. He had learned many things since he had first arrived in Lys, but until now he had not had a single moment for quiet reflection. There was nothing he could do now but sit and wait. His immediate future was controlled by the wonderful machine, surely one of the supreme engineering achievements of all time, that was now carrying him into the heart of the universe. Now was the moment for thought and reflection, whether he wished it or not. But first, he would tell Hilvar all that had happened to him since their hasty parting only 2 days before. Hilvar absorbed the tale without comment, and without asking for any explanations. He seemed to understand at once everything that Alvin described, and showed no signs of surprise even when he heard of the meeting with the central computer and the operation it had performed upon the robot's mind. It was not that he was incapable of wonder, but that the history of the past was full of marvels that could match anything in Alvin's story. When Alvin had finished talking, Hilvar said,
"It's obvious that the central computer must have received special instructions regarding you when it was built. By now you must have guessed why."
"I think so. Kedron gave me part of the answer when he explained how the men who designed Diaspar had taken steps to prevent it becoming decadent."
"Do you think you and the other uniques before you are part of the social mechanism which prevents complete stagnation? So that whereas the jesters are short-term correcting factors, you and your kind are long-term ones?"
Hilvar had expressed the idea better than Alvin could, yet this was not exactly what he had in mind.
"I believe the truth is more complicated than that. It almost looks as if there was a conflict of opinion when the city was built, between those who wanted to shut it off completely from the outside world, and those who wanted to maintain some contacts. The first faction won, but the others did not admit defeat. I think Yarlan Zay must have been one of their leaders, but he was not powerful enough to act openly. He did his best, by leaving the subway in existence and by ensuring that at long intervals someone would come out of the Hall of Creation who did not share the fears of all his fellow men. In fact, I wonder..."
Alvin paused, and his eyes veiled with thought, so that for a moment he seemed oblivious of his surroundings.
"What are you thinking now?"
"It just occurred to me. Perhaps I am Yarlan Zay. It's perfectly possible. He may have fed his personality into the memory banks, relying on it to break the mold of Diaspar before it was too firmly established. One day, I must discover what happened to those earlier uniques. That may help fill in the gaps in the picture."
"And Yarlan Zay, or whoever it was, also instructed the central computer to give special assistance to the uniques, whenever they were created."
"That's right. The ironic thing is that I could have got all the information I needed direct from the central computer, without any assistance from poor Kedron. It would have told me more than it ever told him. But there's no doubt that he saved me a good deal of time, and taught me much that I could never have learned by myself."
"I think your theory covers all the known facts. Unfortunately, it still leaves wide open the biggest problem of all, the original purpose of Diaspar. Why did your people try to pretend that the outer world didn't exist? That's a question I'd like to see answered."
"It's a question I intend to answer, but I don't know when or how.
So they argued and dreamed, while hour by hour the seven suns drifted apart until they had filled that strange tunnel of night in which the ship was riding. Then, one by one, the six outer stars vanished at the brink of darkness, and at last only the central sun was left. Though it could no longer be fully in their space, it still shone with a pearly light that marked it out from all other stars. Minute by minute its brilliance increased, until presently it was no longer a point, but a tiny disk. And now the disk was beginning to expand before them. There was the briefest of warnings. For a moment, a deep, bell-like note vibrated through the room. Alvin clenched the arms of his chair, though it was a futile enough gesture. Once again, the great generators exploded into life, and with an abruptness that was almost blinding, the stars reappeared. The ship had dropped back into space, back into the universe of suns and planets, the natural world, where nothing could move more swiftly than light. They were already within the system of the seven suns, for the great ring of colored globes now dominated the sky. And what a sky it was! All the stars they had known, all the familiar constellations, had gone. The Milky Way was no longer a faint band of mist far to one side of the heavens. They were now at the center of creation, and its great circle divided the universe in twain. The ship was still moving very swiftly toward the central sun, and the six remaining stars of the system were colored beacons ranged around the sky. Not far from the nearest of them were the tiny sparks of circling planets, worlds that must have been of enormous size to be visible over such a distance. The cause of the central sun's nacreous light was now clearly visible. The great star was shrouded in an envelope of gas, which softened its radiation and gave it its characteristic color. The surrounding nebula could only be seen indirectly, and it was twisted into strange shapes that eluded the eye, but it was there. And the longer one stared, the more extensive it seemed to be.
Well, Alvin, we have a good many worlds to take our choice from. Or do you hope to explore them all?
It's lucky that won't be necessary. If we can make contact anywhere, we'll get the information we need. The logical thing would be to head for the largest planet of the central sun.
Unless it's too large. Some planets I've heard were so big that human life could not exist on them. Men would be crushed under their own weight.
I doubt if that will be true here, since I'm sure this system is entirely artificial. In any case, we'll be able to see from space whether there are any cities and buildings.
Hilvar pointed to the robot.
Our problem has been solved for us. But don't forget, our guide has been here before. He's taking us home, and I wonder what he thinks about it.
That was something that Alvin had also wondered. But was it accurate? Did it make any sense at all to imagine that the robot felt anything resembling human emotions, now that it was returning to the ancient home of the master after so many eons? In all his dealings with it, since the central computer had released the blocks that made it mute, the robot had never shown any sign of feelings or emotion. It had answered his questions and obeyed his commands, but its real personality had proved utterly inaccessible to him. That it had a personality, Alvin was sure. Otherwise, he would not have felt that obscure sense of guilt which afflicted him when he recalled the trick he had played upon it, and upon its now dormant companion. It still believed in everything that the master had taught it, though it had seen him fake his miracles and tell lies to his followers. These inconvenient facts did not affect its loyalty. It was able, as had many humans before it, to reconcile two conflicting sets of data. Now it was following its immemorial memories back to their origin. Almost lost in the glare of the central sun was a pale spark of light, with around it the fainter gleams of yet smaller worlds. Their enormous journey was coming to its end. In a little while, they would know if it had been in vain. The planet they were approaching was now only a few million miles away, a beautiful sphere of multicolored light. There could be no darkness anywhere upon its surface, for as it turned beneath the central sun, the other stars would march one by one across its skies. Alvin now saw very clearly the meaning of the Master's dying words. It is lovely to watch the colored shadows on the planets of eternal light. Now they were so close that they could see continents and oceans and a faint haze of atmosphere. Yet there was something puzzling about its markings, and presently they realized that the divisions between land and water were curiously regular. This planet's continents were not as nature had left them. But how small a task the shaping of a world must have been to those who built its suns.
Those aren't oceans at all. Look, you can see markings in them.
Not until the planet was nearer could Alvin see clearly what his friend meant. Then he noticed faint bands and lines along the continental borders, well inside what he had taken to be the limits of the sea. The sight filled him with a sudden doubt, for he knew too well the meaning of those lines. He had seen them once before in the desert beyond Diaspar, and they told him that his journey had been in vain.
This planet is as dry as Earth. Its water has all gone. Those markings are the salt beds where the seas have evaporated.
They would never have let that happen. I think that, after all, we are too late.
His disappointment was so bitter that Alvin did not trust himself to speak again, but stared silently at the great world ahead. With impressive slowness, the planet turned beneath the ship, and its surface rose majestically to meet them. Now they could see buildings, minute white incrustations everywhere save on the ocean beds themselves. Once this world had been the center of the universe. Now it was still. The air was empty, and on the ground were none of the scurrying dots that spoke of life. Yet the ship was still sliding purposely over the frozen sea of stone, a sea which here and there had gathered itself into great waves that challenged the sky. Presently the ship came to rest, as if the robot had at last traced its memories to their source. Below them was a column of snow-white stone, springing from the center of an immense marble amphitheater. Alvin waited for a little while. Then, as the machine remained motionless, he directed it to land at the foot of the pillar. Even until now, Alvin had half hoped to find life on this planet. That hope vanished instantly as the airlock opened. Never before in his life, even in the desolation of Shalmarine, had he been in utter silence. On Earth there was always the murmur of voices, the stir of living creatures, or the sighing of the wind. Here were none of these, nor ever would be again.
Why did you bring us to this spot?
The robot replied.
The master left from here.
I thought that would be the explanation. Don't you see the irony of all this? He fled from this world in disgrace. Now look at the memorial they built for him.
The great column of stone was perhaps 100 times the height of a man, and was set in a circle of metal slightly raised above the level of the plain. It was featureless and bore no inscription. For how many thousands or millions of years, wondered Alvin, had the Master's disciples gathered here to do him honor? And had they ever known that he died in exile on distant Earth? It made no difference now. The Master and his disciples alike were buried in oblivion.
Come outside.
Hilvar tried to jolt Alvin out of his mood of depression.
We have traveled halfway across the universe to see this place. At least you can make the effort to step outdoors.
Despite himself, Alvin smiled and followed Hilvar through the airlock. Once outside, his spirits began to revive a little. Even if this world was dead, it must contain much of interest, much that would help him to solve some of the mysteries of the past. The air was musty, but breathable. Despite the many suns in the sky, the temperature was low. Only the white disk of the central sun provided any real heat, and that seemed to have lost its strength in its passage through the nebulous haze around the star. The other suns gave their quota of color, but no warmth. It took only a few minutes to make sure that the obelisk could tell them nothing. The stubborn material of which it was made showed definite signs of age. Its edges were rounded, and the metal on which it was standing had been worn away by the feet of generations of disciples and visitors. It was strange to think that they might be the last of many billions of human beings ever to stand upon this spot. Hilvar was about to suggest that they should return to the ship and fly across to the nearest of the surrounding buildings, when Alvin noticed a long, narrow crack in the marble floor of the amphitheater. They walked along it for a considerable distance, the crack widening all the time, until presently it was too broad for a man's legs to straddle. A moment later they stood beside its origin. The surface of the arena had been crushed and splintered into an enormous shallow depression, more than a mile long. No intelligence, no imagination was needed to picture its cause. Ages ago, though certainly long after this world had been deserted, an immense cylindrical shape had rested here, then lifted once more into space and left the planet to its memories. Who had they been? Where had they come from? Alvin could only stare and wonder. He would never know if he had missed these earlier visitors by 1,000 or 1,000,000 years. They walked in silence back to their own ship, how tiny that would have looked beside the monster which once had rested here, and flew slowly across the arena until they came to the most impressive of the buildings flanking it. As they landed in front of the ornate entrance, Hilvar pointed out something that Alvin had noticed at the same moment.
These buildings don't look safe. See all that fallen stone over there? It's a miracle they're still standing. If there were any storms on this planet, they would have been flattened ages ago. I don't think it would be wise to go inside any of them.
I'm not going to. I'll send the robot. It can travel far faster than we can, and it won't make any disturbance which might bring the roof crashing down on top of it.
Hilvar approved of this precaution, but he also insisted on one which Alvin had overlooked. Before the robot left on its reconnaissance, Alvin made it pass on a set of instructions to the almost equally intelligent brain of the ship, so that whatever happened to their pilot, they could at least return safely to Earth. It took little time to convince both of them that this world had nothing to offer. Together they watched miles of empty, dust-carpeted corridors and passageways drift across the screen as the robot explored these empty labyrinths. All buildings designed by intelligent beings, whatever form their bodies may take, must comply with certain basic laws. And after a while, even the most alien forms of architecture or design fail to evoke surprise, and the mind becomes hypnotized by sheer repetition, incapable of absorbing any more impressions. These buildings, it seemed, had been purely residential, and the beings who'd lived in them had been approximately human in size. They might well have been men. It was true that there were a surprising number of rooms and enclosures that could be entered only by flying creatures, but that did not mean that the builders of the city were winged. They could have used the personal anti-gravity devices that had once been in common use, but of which there was now no trace in Diaspar.
Alvin, we could spend 1,000,000 years exploring these buildings. It's obvious that they've not merely been abandoned. They were carefully stripped of everything valuable that they possessed. We're wasting our time.
Then what do you suggest?
We should look at 2 or 3 other areas on this planet and see if they are the same, as I expect they are. Then we should make an equally quick survey of the other planets, and only land if they seem fundamentally different or we notice something unusual. That's all we can hope to do unless we are going to stay here for the rest of our lives.
It was true enough. They were trying to contact intelligence, not to carry out archaeological research. The former task could be achieved in a few days, if it could be achieved at all. The latter would take centuries of labor by armies of men and robots. They left the planet 2 hours later, and were thankful enough to go. Even when it had been bustling with life, Alvin decided, this world of endless buildings would have been very depressing. There were no signs of any parks, any open spaces where there could have been vegetation. It had been an utterly sterile world, and it was hard to imagine the psychology of the beings who had lived here. If the next planet was identical with this, Alvin decided, he would probably abandon the search there and then. It was not. Indeed, a greater contrast would have been impossible to imagine. This planet was nearer the sun, and even from space it looked hot. It was partly covered with low clouds, indicating that water was plentiful, but there were no signs of any oceans, nor was there any sign of intelligence. They circled the planet twice without glimpsing a single artifact of any kind. The entire globe, from poles down to the equator, was clothed with a blanket of virulent green.
I think we should be really careful here. This world is alive. And I don't like the color of that vegetation. It would be best to stay in the ship, and not to open the airlock at all.
Not even to send out the robot?
No, not even that. You have forgotten what disease is, and though my people know how to deal with it, we are a long way from home, and there may be dangers here which we cannot see. I think this is a world that has run amok. Once, it may have been all one great garden or park, but when it was abandoned, nature took over again. It could never have been like this while the system was inhabited.
Alvin did not doubt that Hilvar was right. There was something evil, something hostile to all the order and regularity on which Lys and Diaspar were based in the biological anarchy below. Here a ceaseless battle had raged for 1,000,000,000 years. It would be well to be wary of the survivors. They came cautiously down over a great level plain, so uniform that its flatness posed an immediate problem. The plain was bordered by higher ground, completely covered with trees whose height could only be guessed. They were so tightly packed and so enmeshed with undergrowth that their trunks were virtually buried. There were many winged creatures flying among their upper branches, though they moved so swiftly that it was impossible to tell whether they were birds or insects, or neither. Here and there, a forest giant had managed to climb a few scores of feet above its battling neighbors, who had formed a brief alliance to tear it down and destroy the advantage it had won. Despite the fact that this was a silent war, fought too slowly for the eye to see, the impression of merciless, implacable conflict was overwhelming. The plain, by comparison, appeared placid and uneventful. It was flat to within a few inches, right out to the horizon, and seemed to be covered with a thin, wiry grass. Though they descended to within 50 feet of it, there was no sign of any animal life, which Hilvar found somewhat surprising. Perhaps, he decided, it had been scared underground by their approach. They hovered just above the plain while Alvin tried to convince Hilvar that it would be safe to open the airlock, and Hilvar patiently explained such conceptions as bacteria, fungi, viruses, and microbes, ideas which Alvin found hard to visualize and harder still to apply to himself. The argument had been in progress for some minutes before they noticed a peculiar fact. The vision screen, which a moment ago had been showing the forest ahead of them, had now become blank.
Did you turn that off?
Hilvar's mind, as usual, was just one jump ahead of Alvin's.
No.
A cold shiver ran down Alvin's spine as he thought of the only other explanation.
Did you turn it off?
The robot's reply echoed his own.
No.
With a sigh of relief, Alvin dismissed the idea that the robot might have started to act on its own volition, that he might have a mechanical mutiny on his hands.
Then why is the screen blank?
The image receptors have been covered.
I don't understand.
Alvin forgot for a moment that the robot would only act on definite orders or questions. He recovered himself quickly and asked,
"What's covered the receptors?"
"I do not know."
The literal-mindedness of robots could sometimes be as exasperating as the discursiveness of humans. Before Alvin could continue the interrogation, Hilvar interrupted.
"Tell it to lift the ship. Slowly."
There was a note of urgency in his voice. Alvin repeated the command. There was no sense of motion. There never was. Then, slowly, the image reformed on the vision screen, though for a moment it was blurred and distorted, but it showed enough to end the argument about landing. The level plain was level no longer. A great bulge had formed immediately below them, a bulge which was ripped open at the top where the ship had torn free. Huge pseudopods were waving sluggishly across the gap, as if trying to recapture the prey that had just escaped from their clutches. As he stared in horrified fascination, Alvin caught a glimpse of a pulsing scarlet orifice, fringed with whip-like tentacles which were beating in unison, driving anything that came into their reach down into that gaping maw. Foiled of its intended victim, the creature sank slowly into the ground, and it was then that Alvin realized that the plain below was merely the thin scum on the surface of a stagnant sea.
What was that thing?
I'd have to go down and study it before I could tell you that. It may have been some form of primitive animal. Perhaps even a relative of our friend in Shalmarine. Certainly it was not intelligent, or would have known better than to try to eat a spaceship.
Alvin felt shaken, though he knew that they had been in no possible danger. He wondered what else lived down there beneath that innocent sward, which seemed to positively invite him to come out and run upon its springy surface.
I could spend a lot of time here.
Hilvar was obviously fascinated by what he had just seen.
Evolution must have produced some very interesting results under these conditions. Not only evolution, but devolution as well, as higher forms of life regressed when the planet was deserted. By now, equilibrium must have been reached, and you're not leaving already.
His voice sounded quite plaintive as the landscape receded below them.
I am. I've seen a world with no life and a world with too much, and I don't know which I dislike more.
5,000 feet above the plain, the planet gave them one final surprise. They encountered a flotilla of huge, flabby balloons drifting down the wind. From each semi-transparent envelope, clusters of tendrils dangled to form what was virtually an inverted forest. Some plants, it seemed, in the effort to escape from the ferocious conflict on the surface, had learned to conquer the air. By a miracle of adaptation, they had managed to prepare hydrogen and store it in bladders so that they could lift themselves into the comparative peace of the lower atmosphere. Yet it was not certain that even here they had found security. Their downward hanging stems and leaves were infested with an entire fauna of spidery animals, which must spend their lives floating far above the surface of the globe, continuing the universal battle for existence on their lonely aerial islands. Presumably, they must from time to time have some contact with the ground, Alvin saw one of the great balloons suddenly collapse and fall out of the sky, its broken envelope acting as a crude parachute. He wondered if this was an accident or part of the life cycle of these strange entities. Hilvar slept while they waited for the next planet to approach. For some reason, which the robot could not explain to them, the ship traveled slowly, at least by comparison with its universe-spanning haste, now that it was within a star system. It took almost 2 hours to reach the world that Alvin had chosen for his third stop, and he was a little surprised that any mere interplanetary journey should last so long. He woke Hilvar as they dropped down into the atmosphere, pointing to the vision screen.
What do you make of that?
Below them was a bleak landscape of blacks and grays, showing no sign of vegetation or any other direct evidence of life. But there was indirect evidence. The low hills and shallow valleys were dotted with perfectly formed hemispheres, some of them arranged in complex symmetrical patterns. They had learned caution on the last planet, and after carefully considering all the possibilities, remained poised high in the atmosphere while they sent the robot down to investigate. Through its eyes, they saw one of the hemispheres approach until the robot was floating only a few feet away from the completely smooth, featureless surface. There was no sign of any entrance, nor any hint of the purpose which the structure served. It was quite large, over 100 feet high. Some of the other hemispheres were larger still. If it was a building, there appeared to be no way in or out. After some hesitation, Alvin ordered the robot to move forward and touch the dome. To his utter astonishment, it refused to obey him. This indeed was mutiny, or so at first sight it seemed. Alvin recovered from his astonishment.
Why won't you do what I tell you?
It is forbidden.
Forbidden by whom?
I do not know.
Then how? No, cancel that. Was the order built into you?
No.
That seemed to eliminate one possibility. The builders of these domes might well have been the race who made the robot, and might have included this taboo in the machine's original instructions.
When did you receive the order?
I received it when I landed.
Alvin turned to Hilvar, the light of a new hope burning in his eyes.
There's intelligence here. Can you sense it?
No. This place seems as dead to me as the first world we visited.
I'm going outside to join the robot. Whatever spoke to it may speak to me.
Hilvar did not argue the point, though he looked none too happy. They brought the ship to Earth 100 feet away from the dome, not far from the waiting robot, and opened the airlock. Alvin knew that the lock could not be opened unless the ship's brain had already satisfied itself that the atmosphere was breathable. For a moment he thought it had made a mistake. The air was so thin and gave such little sustenance to his lungs. Then, by inhaling deeply, he found that he could grasp enough oxygen to survive, though he felt that a few minutes here would be all that he could endure. Panting hard, they walked up to the robot and to the curving wall of the enigmatic dome. They took one more step, then stopped in unison, as if hit by the same sudden blow. In their minds, like the tolling of a mighty gong, that boomed a single message.
Danger. Come. No. Closer.
That was all. It was a message not in words, but in pure thought. Alvin was certain that any creature, whatever its level of intelligence, would receive the same warning, in the same utterly unmistakable fashion, deep within its mind. It was a warning, not a threat. Somehow they knew that it was not directed against them. It was for their own protection. Here, it seemed to say, is something intrinsically dangerous, and we, its makers, are anxious that no one shall be hurt through blundering ignorantly into it. Alvin and Hilvar stepped back several paces and looked at each other, each waiting for the other to say what was in his mind. Hilvar was the first to sum up the position.
I was right, Alvin. There is no intelligence here. That warning is automatic, triggered by our presence when we get too close.
Alvin nodded in agreement.
I wonder what they were trying to protect. There could be buildings, anything, under these domes.
There's no way we can find out if all the domes warn us off. It's interesting, the difference between the three planets we visited. They took everything away from the first. They abandoned the second without bothering about it. But they went to a lot of trouble here. Perhaps they expected to come back someday and wanted everything to be ready for them when they returned.
But they never did. And that was a long time ago.
They may have changed their minds.
It was curious, Alvin thought, how both he and Hilvar had unconsciously started using the word they. Whoever or whatever they had been, their presence had been strong on that first planet, and was even stronger here. This was a world that had been carefully wrapped up and put away until it might be needed again.
Let's go back to the ship. I can't breathe, Pierre.
As soon as the airlock had closed behind them and they were at ease once more, they discussed their next move. To make a thorough investigation, they should sample a large number of domes in the hope that they might find one that had no warning and which could be entered. If that failed, but Alvin would not face that possibility until he had to. He faced it less than an hour later, and in a far more dramatic form than he would have dreamed. They had sent the robot down to half a dozen domes, always with the same result, when they came across a scene that was badly out of place on this tidy, neatly packaged world. Below them was a broad valley, sparsely sprinkled with the tantalizing impenetrable domes. At its center was the unmistakable scar of a great explosion, an explosion that had thrown debris for miles in all directions and burned a shallow crater in the ground. And beside the crater was the wreckage of a spaceship. They landed close to the scene of this ancient tragedy and walked slowly, conserving their breath, toward the immense broken hull towering above them. Only a short section, either the prow or the stern, of the ship remained. Presumably the rest had been destroyed in the explosion. As they approached the wreck, a thought slowly dawned in Alvin's mind, becoming stronger and stronger until it attained the status of certainty.
Hilvar.
He found it hard to talk and walk at the same time.
I believe this is the ship that landed on the first planet we visited.
Hilvar nodded, preferring not to waste air. The same idea had already occurred to him. It was a good object lesson, he thought, for incautious visitors. He hoped it would not be lost on Alvin. They reached the hull and stared up into the exposed interior of the ship. It was like looking into a huge building that had been roughly sliced in two. Floors and walls and ceilings, broken at the point of the explosion, gave a distorted chart of the ship's cross-section. What strange beings, wondered Alvin, still lay where they had died in the wreckage of their vessel.
I don't understand this. This portion of the ship is badly damaged, but it's still fairly intact. Where's the rest of it? Did it break in two out in space and this part crash here?
Not until they had sent the robot exploring again and had themselves examined the area around the wreckage did they learn the answer. There was no shadow of doubt. Any reservations they might have had were banished when Alvin found the line of low mounds, each 10 feet long, on the little hill beside the ship.
So they landed here and ignored the warning. They were inquisitive just as you are. They tried to open that dome.
He pointed to the other side of the crater, to the smooth, still unmarked shell within which the departed rulers of this world had sealed their treasures. But it was no longer a dome. It was now an almost complete sphere, for the ground in which it had been set had been blasted away.
They wrecked their ship, and many of them were killed. Yet despite that, they managed to make repairs and leave again, cutting off this section and stripping out everything of value. What a task that must have been.
Alvin scarcely heard him. He was looking at the curious marker that had first drawn him to this spot. The slim shaft, ringed by a horizontal circle a third of the way down from its tip. Alien and unfamiliar though it was, he could respond to the mute message it had carried down the ages. Underneath those stones, if he cared to disturb them, was the answer to one question at least. It could remain unanswered. Whatever these creatures might have been, they had earned their right to rest. Hilvar scarcely heard the words Alvin whispered as they walked slowly back to the ship.
I hope they got home.
They were once more out in space when Hilvar said,
"And where now?"
Alvin stared thoughtfully at the screen before replying.
"Do you think I should go back?"
"It would be the sensible thing to do. Our luck may not hold out much longer, and who knows what other surprises these planets may have waiting for us."
It was the voice of sanity and caution, and Alvin was now prepared to give it greater heed than he would have done a few days before. But he had come a long way and waited all his life for this moment. He would not turn back while there was still so much to see.
"We'll stay in this ship from now on, and we won't touch the surface anywhere. That should be safe enough, surely."
Ilvar shrugged his shoulders as if refusing to accept any responsibility for what might happen next. Now that Alvin was showing a certain amount of caution, he thought it unwise to admit that he was equally anxious to continue their exploring, though he had long ago abandoned all hope of meeting intelligent life upon any of these planets. A double world lay ahead of them, a great planet with a smaller satellite beside it. The primary might have been the twin of the second world they had visited. It was clothed in that same blanket of livid green. There would be no point in landing here. This was a story they already knew. Alvin brought the ship low over the surface of the satellite. He needed no warning from the complex mechanism which protected him to know that there was no atmosphere here. All shadows had a sharp, clean edge, and there were no gradations between night and day. It was the first world on which he had seen something approaching night, and only one of the more distant suns was above the horizon in the area where they first made contact. The landscape was bathed in a dull red light, as though it had been dipped in blood. For many miles they flew above mountains that were still as jagged and sharp as in the distant ages of their birth. This was a world that had never known change or decay, had never been scoured by winds and rains. No eternity circuits were needed here to preserve objects in their pristine freshness. But if there was no air, then there could have been no life. Or could there have been? Alvin put the question to him.
Of course. There's nothing biologically absurd in the idea. Life can't originate in airless space, but it can evolve forms that will survive in it. It must have happened millions of times whenever an inhabited planet lost its atmosphere.
But would you expect intelligent life forms to exist in a vacuum? Wouldn't they have protected themselves against the loss of their air?
Probably, if it occurred after they achieved enough intelligence to stop it happening. But if the atmosphere went while they were still in the primitive state, they would have to adapt, or perish. After they had adapted, they might then develop a very high intelligence. In fact, they probably would. The incentive would be so great.
The argument, decided Alvin, was a purely theoretical one, as far as this planet was concerned. Nowhere was there any sign that it had ever borne life, intelligent or otherwise. But in that case, what was the purpose of this world? The entire multiple system of the seven suns, he was now certain, was artificial, and this world must be part of its grand design. It could conceivably be intended purely for ornament, to provide a moon in the sky of its giant companion. Even in that case, however, it seemed likely that it would be put to some use. Ilvar pointed to the screen.
Look, over there, on the right.
Alvin changed the ship's course, and the landscape tilted around them. The red-lit rocks blurred with the speed of their motion. Then the image stabilized, and sweeping below was the unmistakable evidence of life. Unmistakable, yet also baffling. It took the form of a wide-spaced row of slender columns, each 100 feet from its neighbor and twice as high. They stretched into the distance, dwindling in hypnotic perspective until the far horizon swallowed them up. Alvin swung the ship to the right and began to race along the line of columns, wondering as he did so what purpose they could ever have served. They were absolutely uniform, marching in an unbroken file over hills and down into valleys. There was no sign that they had ever supported anything. They were smooth and featureless, tapering very slightly toward the top. Quite abruptly, the line changed its course, turning sharply through a right angle. Alvin overshot by several miles before he reacted and was able to swing the ship around in the new direction. The columns continued with the same unbroken stride across the landscape, their spacing perfectly regular. Then, 50 miles from the last change of course, they turned abruptly through another right angle. At this rate, thought Alvin, we'll soon be back where we started. The endless sequence of columns had so mesmerized them that when it was broken, they were miles past the discontinuity before Ilvar cried out and made Alvin, who had noticed nothing, turn the ship back. They descended slowly, and as they circled above what Ilvar had found, a fantastic suspicion began to dawn in their minds, though at first neither dared mention it to the other. Two of the columns had been broken off near their bases and lay stretched out upon the rocks where they had fallen. Nor was that all. The two columns adjoining the gap had been bent outward by some irresistible force. There was no escape from the awesome conclusion. Now Alva knew what they had been flying over. It was something he had seen often enough in Lys, but until this moment the shocking change of scale had prevented recognition. He hardly dared to put his thought into words.
Hilvard, do you know what this is?
It seems hard to believe, but we've been flying around the edge of a corral. This thing is a fence. A fence that hasn't been strong enough.
People who keep pets should make sure they know how to keep them under control.
Hilvard did not react to this forced levity. He was staring at the broken barricade, his brow furrowed with thought.
I don't understand it. Where could it have got food on a planet like this? And why did it break out of its pen? I'd give a lot to know what kind of animal it was.
Perhaps it was left here and broke out because it was hungry. Or something may have made it annoyed.
Let's go lower. I want to have a look at the ground.
They descended until the ship was almost touching the barren rock, and it was then that they noticed that the plain was pitted with innumerable small holes, no more than an inch or two wide. Outside the stockade, however, the ground was free from these mysterious pockmarks. They stopped abruptly at the line of the fence.
You were right. It was hungry, but it wasn't an animal. It would be more accurate to call it a plant. It had exhausted the soil inside its pen and had to find fresh food elsewhere. It probably moved quite slowly. Perhaps it took years to break down those posts.
Alvin's imagination swiftly filled in the details he could never know with certainty. He did not doubt that Hilvar's analysis was basically correct, and that some botanical monster, perhaps moving too slowly for the eye to see, had fought a sluggish but relentless battle against the barriers that hemmed it in. It might still be alive, even after all these ages, roving at will over the face of this planet. To look for it, however, would be a hopeless task, since it would mean quartering the surface of an entire globe. They made a desultory search in the few square miles around the gap and located one great circular patch of pockmarks, almost 500 feet across, where the creature had obviously stopped to feed. If one could apply that word to an organism that somehow drew its nourishment from solid rock. As they lifted once more into space, Alvin felt a strange weariness come over him. He had seen so much, yet learned so little. There were many wonders on all these planets, but what he sought had fled them long ago. It would be useless, he knew, to visit the other worlds of the Seven Suns. Even if there was still intelligence in the universe, where could he seek it now? He looked at the stars scattered like dust across the vision screen, and knew that what was left of time was not enough to explore them all. A feeling of loneliness and oppression, such as he had never before experienced, seemed to overwhelm him. He could understand now the fear of Diaspar for the great spaces of the universe, the terror that had made his people gather in the little microcosm of their city. It was hard to believe that, after all, they had been right. He turned to Hilvar for support, but Hilvar was standing, fists tightly clenched, and with a glazed look in his eye. His head was tilted on one side. He seemed to be listening, straining every sense into the emptiness around them.
What is it?
Alvin had to repeat the question before Hilvar showed any sign of hearing it. He was still staring into nothingness when he finally replied.
There's something coming. Something that I don't understand.
It seemed to Alvin that the cabin had suddenly become very cold, and the racial nightmare of the invaders reared up to confront him in all its terror. With an effort of will that sapped his strength, he forced his mind away from panic.
Is it friendly? Shall I run for Earth?
Hilvar did not answer the first question, only the second. His voice was very faint, but showed no sign of alarm or fear. It held rather a vast astonishment and curiosity, as if he had encountered something so surprising that he could not be bothered to deal with Alvin's anxious query.
You're too late. It's already here.
The galaxy had turned many times on its axis since consciousness first came to Vanimond. He could recall little of those first eons and the creatures who had tended him then. But he could remember still his desolation when they had gone and left him alone among the stars. Down the ages since, he had wandered from sun to sun, slowly evolving and increasing his powers. Once he had dreamed of finding again those who had attended his birth, and though the dream had faded now, it had never wholly died. On countless worlds he had found the wreckage that life had left behind, but intelligence he had discovered only once, and from the black sun he had fled in terror. Yet the universe was very large, and the search had scarcely begun. Far away though it was in space and time, the great burst of power from the heart of the galaxy beckoned to Vanimon across the light years. It was utterly unlike the radiation of the stars, and it had appeared in his field of consciousness as suddenly as a meteor trail across a cloudless sky. He moved through space and time toward it, to the latest moment of its existence, sloughing from him in the way he knew the dead, unchanging pattern of the past. The long metal shape, with its infinite complexities of structure, he could not understand, for it was as strange to him as almost all the things of the physical world. Around it still clung the aura of power that had drawn him across the universe, but that was of no interest to him now. Carefully, with the delicate nervousness of a wild beast half poised for flight, he reached out toward the two minds he had discovered. And then he knew that his long search was ended. Alvin grasped Hilvar by the shoulders and shook him violently, trying to drag him back to a greater awareness of reality.
Tell me what's happening. What do you want me to do?
The remote abstracted look slowly faded from Hilvar's eyes.
I still don't understand. But there's no need to be frightened. I'm sure of that. Whatever it is, it won't harm us. It seems simply interested.
Alvin was about to reply when he was suddenly overwhelmed by a sensation unlike any he had ever known before. A warm, tingling glow seemed to spread through his body. It lasted only a few seconds, but when it was gone, he was no longer merely Alvin. Something was sharing his brain, overlapping it as one circle may partly cover another. He was conscious also of Hilvar's mind, close at hand, equally entangled in whatever creature had descended upon them. The sensation was strange, rather than unpleasant, and it gave Alvin his first glimpse of true telepathy, the power which in his people had so degenerated that it could now be used only to control machines. Alvin had rebelled at once when Serranus had tried to dominate his mind, but he did not struggle against this intrusion. It would have been useless, and he knew that this creature, whatever it might be, was not unfriendly. He let himself relax, accepting without resistance the fact that an infinitely greater intelligence than his own was exploring his mind. But in that belief, he was not wholly right. One of these minds, Vanimon saw at once, was more sympathetic and accessible than the other. He could tell that both were filled with wonder at his presence, and that surprised him greatly. It was hard to believe that they could have forgotten. Forgetfulness, like mortality, was beyond the comprehension of Vanimond. Communication was very difficult. Many of the thought images in their minds were so strange that he could hardly recognize them. He was puzzled and a little frightened by the recurrent fear pattern of the invaders. It reminded him of his own emotions when the black sun first came into his field of knowledge. But they knew nothing of the black sun, and now their own questions were beginning to form in his mind.
What are you?
He gave the only reply he could.
I am Vanimon.
There came a pause. How long the pattern of their thoughts took to form. And then the question was repeated. They had not understood. That was strange, for surely their kind had given him his name, for it to be among the memories of his birth. Those memories were very few, and they began strangely at a single point in time, but they were crystal clear. Again their tiny thoughts struggled up into his consciousness.
Where are the people who built the seven suns? What happened to them?
He did not know. They could scarcely believe him, and their disappointment came sharp and clear across the abyss separating their minds from his. But they were patient, and he was glad to help them, for their quest was the same as his, and they gave him the first companionship he had ever known. As long as he lived, Alvin did not believe he would ever again undergo so strange an experience as this soundless conversation. It was hard to believe that he could be little more than a spectator, for he did not care to admit, even to himself, that Hilvar's mind was in some ways so much more capable than his own. He could only wait and wonder, half dazed by the torrent of thought just beyond the limits of his understanding. Presently, Hilvar, rather pale and strained, broke off the contact and turned to his friend. His voice was very tired.
Alvin, there's something strange here. I don't understand it at all.
The news did a little to restore Alvin's self-esteem, and his face must have shown his feelings, for Hilvar gave a sudden, sympathetic smile.
I can't discover what this Vanimond is. It's a creature of tremendous knowledge, but it seems to have very little intelligence. Of course, its mind may be of such a different order that we can't understand it. Yet, somehow, I don't believe that is the right explanation.
Well, what have you learned? Does it know anything about the Seven Suns?
Hilvar's mind still seemed very far away.
They were built by many races, including our own. It can give me facts like that, but it doesn't seem to understand their meaning. I believe it's conscious of the past, without being able to interpret it. Everything that's ever happened seems jumbled together in its mind.
He paused thoughtfully for a moment, then his face lightened.
There's only one thing to do. Somehow or other, we must get Vanimond to Earth so that our philosophers can study him.
Would that be safe?
Hilvar thought how uncharacteristic his friend's remark was.
Yes, Vanimond is friendly. More than that, in fact. He seems almost affectionate.
And quite suddenly, the thought that all the while had been hovering at the edge of Alvin's consciousness came clearly into view. He remembered Kriff and all the small animals that were constantly escaping, to the annoyance or alarm of Hilvar's friends. And he recalled, how long ago that seemed, the zoological purpose behind their expedition to Shalmarain. Hilvar had found a new pet. How completely unthinkable, Jeserac mused, this conference would have seemed only a few short days ago. The six visitors from Lys sat facing the council, along a table placed across the open end of the horseshoe. It was ironic to remember that not long ago, Alvin had stood at the same spot and heard the council rule that Diaspar must be closed again from the world. Now the world had broken in upon it with a vengeance, and not only the world, but the universe. The council itself had already changed. No less than five of its members were missing. They had been unable to face the responsibilities and problems now confronting them and had followed the path that Kedron had already taken. It was, thought Jeserek, proof that Diaspar had failed if so many of its citizens were unable to face their first real challenge in millions of years. Many thousands of them had already fled into the brief oblivion of the memory banks, hoping that when they awoke, the crisis would be past and Diaspar would be its familiar self again. They would be disappointed. Jeserek had been co-opted to fill one of the vacant places on the council. Though he was under something of a cloud, owing to his position as Alvin's tutor, his presence was so obviously essential that no one had suggested excluding him. He sat at one end of the horseshoe-shaped table, a position which gave him several advantages. Not only could he study the profiles of his visitors, but he could also see the faces of his fellow counselors, and their expressions were sufficiently instructive. There was no doubt that Alvin had been right, and the council was slowly realizing the unpalatable truth. The delegates from Lys could think far more swiftly than the finest minds in Diaspar. Nor was that their only advantage, for they also showed an extraordinary degree of coordination, which Jeserek guessed must be due to their telepathic powers. He wondered if they were reading the counselor's thoughts, but decided that they would not have broken the solemn assurance without which this meeting would have been impossible. Jeserek did not think that much progress had been made. For that matter, he did not see how it could have been made. The council, which had barely accepted the existence of Lys, still seemed incapable of realizing what had happened. but it was clearly frightened, and so, he guessed, were the visitors, though they managed to conceal the fact better. Jezerek himself was not as terrified as he had expected. His fears were still there, but he had faced them at last. Something of Alvin's own recklessness, or was it courage, had begun to change his outlook and give him new horizons. He did not believe he would ever be able to set foot beyond the walls of Diaspar, but now he understood the impulse that had driven Alvin to do so. The president's question caught him unawares, but he recovered himself quickly.
I think that it was sheer chance that this situation never arose before. We know that there were 14 earlier uniques, and that there must have been some definite plan behind their creation. That plan, I believe, was to ensure that Lys and Diaspar would not remain apart forever. Alvin has seen to that. But he has also done something which I do not imagine was ever in the original scheme. Could the central computer confirm that?
The impersonal voice replied at once.
The counselor knows that I cannot comment on the instructions given to me by my designers.
Jezerek accepted the mild reproof.
Whatever the cause, we cannot dispute the facts. Alvin has gone out into space. When he returns, you may prevent him leaving again, though I doubt if you will succeed, for he may have learned a great deal by then. And if what you fear has happened, there is nothing any of us can do about it. Earth is utterly helpless. She has been for millions of centuries.
Jezerek paused and glanced along the tables. His words had pleased no one, nor had he expected them to do so.
Yet I do not see why we should be alarmed. Earth is in no greater danger now than she has always been. Why should two men in a single small ship bring the wrath of the invaders down upon us again? If we'll be honest with ourselves, we must admit that the invaders could have destroyed our world ages ago.
There was a disapproving silence. This was heresy, and once Jezerek himself would have condemned it as such. The president interrupted, frowning heavily.
Is there not a legend that the invaders spared Earth itself only on condition that man never went into space again? And have we not now broken those conditions?
A legend, yes. We accept many things without question, and this is one of them. However, there is no proof of it. I find it hard to believe that anything of such importance would not be recorded in the memories of the central computer. Yet it knows nothing of this pact. I have asked it, though only through the information machines. The Council may care to ask the question directly.
Jezerek saw no reason why he should risk a second admonishment by trespassing on forbidden territory, and waited for the President's reply. It never came, for in that moment, the visitors from Lys suddenly started in their seats, while their faces froze in simultaneous expressions of incredulity and alarm. They seemed to be listening, while some faraway voice poured its message into their ears. The counselors waited, their own apprehension growing minute by minute as the soundless conversation proceeded. Then the leader of the delegation shook himself free from his trance and turned apologetically to the president.
We have just had some very strange and disturbing news from Lys.
Has Alvin returned to Earth?
No, not Alvin. Something else.
As he brought his faithful ship down in the glade of Airlie, Alvin wondered if ever in human history any ship had brought such a cargo to Earth, if indeed Vanimon was located in the physical space of the machine. There had been no sign of him on the voyage. Hilvar believed, and his knowledge was more direct, that only Vanimon's sphere of attention could be said to have any position in space. Vanimon himself was not located anywhere, perhaps not even any when. Serranus and five senators were waiting for them as they emerged from the ship. One of the senators Alvin had already met on his last visit. The other two from that previous meeting were, he gathered, now in Diaspar. He wondered how the delegation was faring, and how the city had reacted to the presence of the first intruders from outside in so many millions of years. Serranus greeted her son, and then said dryly,
It seems, Alvin, that you have a genius for discovering remarkable entities. Still, I think it will be some time before you can surpass your present achievement.
For once, it was Alvin's turn to be surprised.
Then Vanimon's arrived?
Yes, hours ago. Somehow he managed to trace the path your ship made on its outward journey. A staggering feat in itself, and one which raises interesting philosophical problems. There is some evidence that he reached Lys at the moment you discovered him.